Welcome to Sounding Board Parenting, creating healthier human connections through the commonality of parenting, exploring the world of parenting with high-performing mums and dads from a range of backgrounds, industries, and family dynamics. This week's guest is Julie Lithcott-Hames, whose life roles include human, mother to Sawyer, who is 20, and Avery, who is 18, life partner to Dan, with time left over to author a New York Times best-selling book based on parenting, and a TED speaker whose talk has had over 4.5 million views so far. Word of warning, Julie is not a cyborg. We simply had a few internet issues throughout the chat. Let's jump in.
How has parenting changed your life?
Whew. Sean, I have two children, a son, Sawyer, who's 20, a daughter, Avery, who's 18, and the sound of their laughter with one another is the most beautiful music I've ever heard. I guess that's my way of saying my life has been fundamentally altered by their existence. And I feel such a humble gratitude to the universe, to God, to my life partner, for the fact that I just get to have these humans in my life. So that's kind of the big picture. How's my life been altered? And then there's the really practical, like, oh my gosh, you know, parenting is so immense and omnipresent as a task. It's an always thing. And, you know, the years of just exhaustion and the fear of, am I doing it right or wrong? Do I know the answer? Did I handle it well? The worry, the blame when things go wrong, and the hope that everything will be all right. I mean, the emotions of parenting are just so big. And then on top of it, I'm a parenting expert of sorts. I don't like to call myself that, but others call me that. I see myself as a lawyer who became a university dean who saw a problem in my students that turned out to have the way they were raised at its core. And so I became a parenting expert unwittingly by writing about a problematic way of parenting that was harming young adults. And so my professional life is about what have we done to our kids, you know, the evidence we can see in young adults failing to launch. And then I've got these 18 and 20 year olds who are my own children and asking myself, oh no, did I do that too? And the answer is yes. And so my personal and professional lives are completely intertwined right now. And have been for some time. I try to ask the professional expert in me to advise the parent in me how to do the right thing. And the parent in me is always aware of what the right thing is, but it's hard to implement it in my actual life sometimes. So there's quite an overlap. It's very complex. But I think ultimately I'm a better parent of my own children because I was concerned about what was happening with other people's children.
What roles would you say you play in life?
First of all, I love you already. I barely know you, but I've been on hundreds of podcasts and I don't get asked questions like this. So thank you for offering the space for a very intriguing conversation. And of course, it's always fun to be in Australia, even virtually.
My pleasure. It's awesome to have you here.
Thank you. I've been to Sydney and to Melbourne, actually, with this book, How to Raise an Adult, years ago, probably 2016, my first and only visit so far to your beautiful country. So what did you say? What roles do I play in life?
Yes.
Human, mother, partner. Those are probably the first three that come to mind. I try to play roles that are consistent with one another. I don't like the notion of, well, I'm putting this hat on now and then I'm putting this hat on, the notion that we might show up differently in different spaces. I'm 52, I've worked a lot of my shit out, if I may say so. I don't know if you're a clean podcast. You don't want me to say that.
That's okay. Still parent friendly, right?
Parent friendly. I've done this parenting book, but also a memoir on growing up Black and biracial in the United States and dealing with racism and microaggressions and the ways in which all of those experiences heaped themselves upon me and made me think less of myself, weighed me down. And I've worked that through largely. And so I'm in a place of freedom where I feel I can be who I am and I can do the things I want to do. And I don't worry nearly as much as I did when I was your age about what people thought or what people were going to say or how I was going to be judged. So I just feel a lot of unbridled freedom mostly. That allows me to say I want to be a human and a partner and a mother and a worker, a family member, a contributor to my community in a way that I hope is consistent across all those roles. And that gives me a lot of relief and joy.
How do you feel right now reflecting on those roles and how parenting's changed your life?
You know, this happens to be the time of coronavirus, of COVID-19, where everything feels to have shrunk into a tiny little capsule. Somehow, my 20 and 18-year-old offspring are back in my house. My 81-year-old mother lives in an attached cottage. We all own this property together. Five of us are here, whereas, you know, just as recently as 6 months ago, 7 months ago, my offspring were both in different states, and it was me and my husband empty nesting, and there was a lot of freedom in that. And so I feel that with our son and daughter having come back home, we are rediscovering them and who we are with them and what we want to be with them and what do we have to offer them. They've left and returned. And it's a strange dynamic, but in some ways I think it's allowing us to lay down new patterns that might be healthier than old ones were, or that if it's not about healthier or better or worse, it's about we are still in the act of supporting these young people in making their way, and they're older now and the circumstances are weird and different, but we can choose in every moment how we show up in the life of our child. Is it in a manner that is controlling? Is it enabling of bad behaviors? Is it harmful, or is it supportive and supporting and with the appropriate psychological distance? I endeavor always, and I have a fairly highly developed mindfulness practice, so I'm very good at observing myself as I behave and as I speak. And so I'm sort of delighting in the fact that nowadays I know that though I was in their young childhood a parent who just always wanted to make every little thing better and easier and handle it and so on, I know because I've read the research, I know that that's harmful. And so I show up now asking myself always, how can I be next to this young person, care about them, love them, ask good questions, take an interest, but not own it? It's their life. If I try to drag them down a path toward what I think is right, or if I just manicure their path so it's all a little bit easier, or if I push them from behind down their path, all of those behaviors, however lovingly intended, will impede their progress, will undermine their agency. They will not be able to do for themselves. They will develop learned helplessness. I've read about that. And I've experienced myself doing those things, and I'm seeing some hints of that in my offspring. So I am trying constantly now not to do the holding the hand or the pushing from behind or the fixing it as they go, but simply to be near them, near enough so they feel the love and they feel the care, but detached enough so that my psyche doesn't encroach upon theirs and damage their process of developing agency.
It's interesting because in life, the story usually goes that parents are the ones that are teaching our kids the way to go through life. I'm interested to know, what have you learned from your children?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the reverse, isn't it? I have so many examples of it being the reverse, of my children being my greatest teacher. One example that's just popping to mind super clearly right now for me is from this time of coronavirus, where, as I mentioned, we're a household of four, but really a property of five, because my mother's in this attached cottage. And she's 81, as I mentioned, and about 2 weeks into our shelter in place, she got a little huffy and announced on the front patio, which we kind of all share. She said, you know, she had her bag and her coat, and she said, "I'm going to the store. You know, I'm just," and she looked cross. And I said, and my husband said, and our daughter, our 18-year-old, was also nearby. And so we were all trying to stop her from going out, because at her age, the risk is so high. Mm-hmm. So we're bringing the various arguments about why, you know, do you need something? We can go get it for you. You know, you really shouldn't. They've asked us all to shelter in place, and particularly anyone over 65 is not supposed to go. You know, all of the rules were coming, and the compassion was coming, and the helpfulness, and she just wasn't hearing it. And, you know, she then said, you know, "I just need to see people. I just need some contact." And we were like, "Okay, you know, but we're all here for you." And she said, "I haven't seen you, you know, the three of you haven't, you know, I haven't seen you more than three times in 2 weeks." And I got defensive. I said, "Mom, what are you talking about? I see you every day. You know, it's been 2 weeks and I think I've seen you 20 times, not three times." And she just pushed back, and I pushed, and, you know, we were just arguing at this point. I mean, and finally I just took a deep breath and I said, "Mom, you know, you, this is up to you. Obviously we're not going to chain you down, but please know that, if something happens to you, we're not allowed to come visit you in the hospital, you know?" And I said, "I'm offering this as one last effort to stop you from going, because I'm hearing from other people that this is the thing that convinces their elderly relatives not to leave the house like that, you know." Nevertheless, my mother, who's very type A, very strong-willed, as I am, as my daughter is, she says, "I'm leaving, I'm going." She says, "Here's what I'll tell you. If I go to the store and it's crowded, I'll come home. But if it's not, I'm going to get the few things that I need and maybe stop at the post office." So fine, she went. And I was just feeling such anger and defensiveness, because my mother was basically saying, "I have to leave the house in violation of our government's orders because you all are not spending enough time with me." That's how I was hearing it. And I knew that I was making efforts every single day to see her in the middle of a busy online life of writing and speaking and trying to, you know, I was making sure I was popping over to see my mother. I knew I was making that effort. So I felt really defensive and insulted, and, you know, that she wasn't noticing. So I'm sorry this is such a long story, but I think it's worth telling, because my daughter, who's 18, said to me after my mother left, she said, "Mom, you know, I think maybe both you and Gaga are right." And Gaga is what she calls my mother, her grandmother. She said, "I think maybe both you and Gaga are right." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, to you, you're going over 20 times in 2 weeks, like you're constantly checking in. But to Gaga, a visit is come in, sit down, have a cup of tea, stay for an hour. And so your definition of visit and her definition of visit just aren't the same. So you're both right." Well, my daughter
delivered you some perspective by the sounds of it.
Talk about being my teacher. So my mother comes home and she apologizes. She says, "I was so stressed out and cranky, and I think I know why. The technology is driving me crazy. My phone is pinging with WhatsApp updates from our British family and Facebook message updates from our American family. And now I'm on Zoom." You know, she said, "My phone is constantly making noise and it's driving me crazy." And she said, "I know you're used to it, Julie, because you're that generation." I said, "No, Mom, that would drive anybody crazy. Let me show you how to turn off your notifications, you know?" So, and then I said, "Let me tell you what Avery shared with me, which is that maybe your definition of visit and mine are not the same. And that's why we're having trouble meeting eye to eye." And she totally got that and appreciated that. And of course, I had already come to that myself. And I, from that day forward, have had a morning coffee for an hour with my mother. That's how I start every day. And that lesson And that wisdom is something I learned from my 18-year-old child.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that story. It's interesting how a child, like we said at the start of this, it's usually told as though we're the ones that are delivering all the lessons. It's amazing how they can, just with that one comment, that one observation, just flip a perspective like that of their parents.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool.
I'm going to tell you one other story, which is brief, but and different. So that's why I want to share it.
Please.
I've always been kind of particular in the kitchen. I cook often. I'm a good cook. I'm not a great cook, but I know what I want, and I have a sense of if I'm delivering a meal with five different components, I want it all to be there ready on time. And I want, when I say it's time for dinner and I've given the, it's almost time for dinner, now it's time for dinner, I want everyone to like be at the table and enjoy the food while it's hot. That's one of my things. And I get stressed, and my husband's a great sous chef when I'm cooking something. And anyway, I just feel like the way I am in the kitchen is normal. I don't think I'm obnoxious, but I also know I'm not relaxed. I think I'm somewhere in this space of, but the feedback I've gotten from my son indirectly is that I'm very controlling in the kitchen. And the way I've gotten this feedback is he asks specific questions when he's cooking something. He's like, do I do this or this? How do I know if it's this or this? And when he asks me those questions, I get a little irritated, like, come on, just figure it out. You can do this. But over time, I've come to appreciate, no, he can't, because I've raised him to feel like the consequences of choice A or B matter. So he's afraid to make the wrong choice. And I've been the one to create that dynamic. So the other day when he said, I'm putting this in the microwave, do I put it on 40 seconds or, 50 seconds? So it's, but something that minute. I said, Sawyer, sweetheart, I realize I'm the one that's made you worry that it matters, and it really doesn't, so just try it, see what works. That's really the way to get to be comfortable in the kitchen. And I really had to own that. Like, I have made you fearful that an imprecise choice here, an imprecise decision made might be harmful, and it's not. It rarely is, unless you're making a souffle, and I don't even make souffle, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But it was his sort of letting me know that he needed the answer. He was afraid to move forward without clarity. And I know I'm the one who basically raised him to be that way. So we're working on undoing that dynamic.
That awareness that you just talked about is awesome. And I'm interested to know, when did that awareness start to arise for yourself?
Well, Sean, I was writing a book, How to Raise an Adult, which became my anti-helicopter parenting manifesto in 2014. And digging into this problem of helicopter parenting on the page to give advice to others. Let's see, how old would Sawyer have been in 2014? He would have been 15 years old. So what I came to appreciate as I was writing the book was I've had evidence in my own life that I am contributing to the problem I purport to be an expert on and I'm writing about. And the first example that came to mind as I was trying to own on the page as the author that I too am complicit in this problem, the example that I came to was when Sawyer had been a 10-year-old and Avery had been 8, I had been railing against this overparenting on my campus at the university where I was a dean. But I came home for dinner one night, years into my concern on this subject, and Sawyer was 10. We were having chicken, and I leaned over his plate and began cutting his meat. And that was my first clue that, oh my goodness, I am going to be one of those parents who can't let go of an 18-year-old because I'm holding on too tight to my 10-year-old. That is, I'm doing more for him now than I should. And that's going to foster a dependency on me, which means he'll be less skilled at 12 and at 14 and at 16 and 18. So of course I'm going to have to hold on to him at 18 and do for him at university what one would hope an 18-year-old could do for themselves. Why? Because all the way back in time, I've been over helping instead of walking away with a smile and letting him try things for himself.
You started to go into it there, and I'm interested to know, what challenges have you faced as a parent?
I have all of this in hindsight. I certainly wasn't aware of it as I was doing it, but you know, I break the overparenting types into either the authoritarian, my way or the highway, tiger parent, you will do as I say, you'll be a brain surgeon, you'll be a concert pianist, you know, you have to do these things, because those, I'm not that type. I'm the indulgent, permissive type, which is I just want my kids to be happy, I want everything to be good and calm, and I'll just handle it myself in order to ensure it's perfect or fine or handled or easier. And I've really, I've very much exhibited those behaviors. That said, I can't let myself off the hook completely for the authoritarian. I'm not mean, or, you know, I don't expect you will be a this or that, but let me frame it this way. Like, you're so smart and I want the best for you. And, you know, so this science interest that you have, like, yes, go be a research scientist and change the world. As I've heard my son saying those things throughout childhood, I've been there going like, yes, I would love that. I would, you know, he says, maybe I'll get a Nobel Prize. And a little piece of me is like, yes, go get that Nobel Prize. That would be amazing. And, you know, I'm not literally expecting my kid to get a Nobel Prize, but I have a lot of energy invested in how good he is in the sciences, and wanting that for him and for us. You know, I have relaxed my expectations about where my kids will go to college. I attended brand name college and law school myself, and I certainly was of that ilk for a while, like they need to go to the kind of schools I went to. I've relaxed that a lot, appreciating there are great educational offerings at so many places beyond the big brands. I totally believe that. And yet, to go to college or not, a friend of mine pulled me aside about 6 weeks ago and said, you know, does your kid know that they don't have to go to college? And I was like, well, they do have to go to college. And she said, well, do they, you know, is that necessary? And I said, well, you know, my son isn't, you know, he's biracial, but he presents as an African-American male in America. And if you don't have a college degree, I mean, it's already so hard to prove you're capable in a racist society when you are of color, you know. So yeah, he has to go to college, but her point was, maybe that's such a weight for him. And if you were able to relax on that with confidence that if he is given time and space to decide who he is and what he wants, maybe college is in the picture, maybe it's not. The more important thing there is that he's doing the deciding rather than feeling like he's forced down a path in life, of his mother's making.
Those Nobel Prize winning moments you just described, do you see that as being to do with making decisions for him, or is that to do with yourself in terms of, let's put it a different way. I've caught myself at times as a parent, and Oscar's only 2.5. However, I've still caught myself at times making parenting decisions or thinking as a parent, but it's actually been to do with an inner child, I think, within me, not Oscar. Have you had many moments like that? Do you see that in your work as well?
Yeah, for sure. The number of times, I'm going to mention something about my son, and I'm going to mention it now in response to your question, you know, as an illustration of this point you're making. Very aware that every single time I've mentioned it, I'm actually contributing to the problem of it. So let me stop. Let me get out of the murk of what is she talking about and be concrete here. My son did exceptionally well on a standardized test that really, you know, almost a perfect score, which hardly anybody gets. And you know, with the college admission scandal in the United States a year ago, rich parents were trying to buy scores for their kids, but they wouldn't dare have tried to purchase a score as high as my kid earned on his own. Okay, it's that high. And I have been so proud of that score. And I mention it a lot in my talks as a way to let people know how smart my kid is, because ultimately I'm telling a story of how I've put pressure on my kid to do X, Y, and Z. So as I tell these stories, I'm building up for the audience just how accomplished this kid is, so that they can really see how far ultimately I've come as a parent in letting those expectations of what he will do and be in the world just go by the wayside and let him just do what he wants. But I'll tell you that every time I tell the story of my son's great high score, the child I was who didn't test well and felt as a black child, you know, I've only gotten where I've gotten. People say I've only gotten into places because of my race, which has been a pain for me for decades. You know, here I now have this black son who's done exceptionally well, you know, who will, you know, I am living vicariously through that. It's like, I know he won't have that stigma in his mind that I had of people telling me I didn't deserve to be where I was. Like, he knows he's got the score. He knows, you know, doesn't matter, right? So I'm definitely living, you know, just needing for the world to know. This is now emotion in my voice as I say this. Like, this child, you know, do not point your finger at him with your nasty racism and say he didn't earn what he has, because this child has it innate. You know, that's the sort of stuff I'm trying to work out and sort out. Man, what racism will do and infect you and make you feel less about yourself. I'm 52. I've spent since I was 17, probably, or 16. I've spent those many decades trying to prove that I have a brain and I am worthy and I am smart and I am accomplished and I'm hardworking, to undo the racist trope that is, oh no, you're not. You just got there because you have brown skin.
Thank you for sharing that, Julie. It's, for me, obviously being in Australia, it can be hard to comprehend. With that being said, I have a lot of close and distant friends that are of Australian Indigenous Aboriginal.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time in recent years actually in other work that I've done in remote communities. And I've seen and heard stories of similar ilk to what you're talking about there. And it's something that I've only gained some perspective on in recent years. So again, I just want to say thank you for sharing that with me as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for holding space for me to share it.
Let
me just add one other caveat there, which is, in contrast, so while what I have experienced and just shared brief glimpses of as an African-American person bears some resemblance to what Aboriginal Australians, Indigenous Aboriginal Australian people have experienced, I also know I'm extremely privileged. I was raised middle class in America and am now upper middle class. And so the pains of racism are, I think, ameliorated to a large extent if you have a financial status that means you at least can keep going and you can pay your bills and you can have opportunities and access. So I don't want to equate what I've experienced to that of people who have far less than me. But I do appreciate your making the connection, because I think some of those stories nevertheless have similar elements to them.
Let's take a sharp left into the space of parenting joys. What are the biggest parenting joys that come to mind for you?
Just watching who my kids are in the world. My husband and I, my partner, we use that term even though we're a heterosexual couple. We've been together for 32 years since university, and we tended, before most, we were using language like heteronormative in our family to acknowledge the fact that, you know, our world tends to presume everybody's straight and not everybody is. And so we use language, words like heteronormative, well before most people, and maybe some of your listeners are like, I still don't use that word, but you know, it's become a more commonly used term, but we've been using it for years. And So one day we were at a summer, one week we were at a summer camp in South Lake Tahoe, this beautiful region in the United States, high elevation, beautiful lake, summer camp for alumni of Stanford University, where my husband and I both went. And every year we go the same week. So that means our kids have grown up with the same kids. They see them every summer. And so our son was 12, and his camping group of 11 and 12 year olds had been doing some silly activity where they were simulating a wedding, and everybody played a part, and Sawyer had volunteered or was picked to be the officiant of the wedding. And the wedding, this mock wedding, was between a male and a female. So apparently, and we didn't know any of this as it's going on, we're enjoying our adult activities, but like that night at dinner, my son's camp counselor, who was also a student of mine, because I was still a dean at Stanford at the time and the staff were all Stanford students, this counselor who would have been like a 20-year-old. So the camp counselor comes to us at dinner that day and tells us this story of, you know, what happened at camp and how there was this mock wedding, and he has tears in his eyes. And he says, your kid goes, well, this is heteronormative, as he's starting to officiate this wedding. And the counselor has tears in his eyes, and he goes, thank you for raising this kid such that he knows that concept and feels confident expressing it in his peers of fellow 11 and 12-year-olds. He made it possible for me, the one gay counselor on the staff of, in his group, to not have to say it. That a 12-year-old said it was such a beautiful thing. You know, I didn't have to. He did some of the heavy lifting for me. This counselor and current student of mine at the time is saying through tears. And that's just an example of when Dan's my partner, when we're in the house talking about heteronormative or Black Lives Matter, or, you know, what are we doing to serve people who have less than us? You know, you don't know as a parent how much of this sticks, how much of it lands, stays, roots, germinates inside our kids' bodies and minds. You know, what do they take out in the world? So when you get a glimpse of your child acting in a way that feels honorable and good and kind, that is the greatest joy, you know, just because you know, who they are in the world impacts everyone that's around them for good or for evil, right? For good or bad. And to get a glimpse that somebody's life was made a little bit better because of how your child behaved is a tremendous joy.
That's beautiful, and honestly, from my opinion, quite rare still for a 12-year-old to have that awareness as well, and to have that impact on their peers at that age is quite remarkable, because it's an age where I feel like heading into those teen years, they're trying to find their tribe. Like they're almost trying to find their pack, which might involve that sheep mentality or just trying to belong, and to be able to be so authentic and an individual in that moment. That's awesome. I really appreciate you sharing that. It's really cool.
Time for a short reflection break. This is an opportunity for you to stop, take a breath, and reflect on your past week as a parent. If you have a pen and paper near you, that's great. If not, simply use your phone or laptop. I want you to write down three things. First, write down one moment in the past week that you were proud of yourself as a parent. Second, write down one area of your parenting that you would like to improve for the next week. Third, write down one moment from the past week where your child or children have made you smile. Be kind to yourself and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
He's a terrific kid, and this is the humility that comes with parenting. I don't take credit for who he is as a person. I'm just trying not to screw him up and, you know, just trying to give him the tools he needs to become himself. But of course, you know, there are ways in which I think I have gotten in the way. But his character and his manner, and hers as well, I'm talking a lot about Sawyer, Avery is very different in terms of personality, but you know, also an incredibly kind person. And I think, you know, they were that way from infancy. And it's just, it's awe-inspiring to watch another human become, you know, their older self daily, weekly, yearly. I can see in my 18 and 20-year-old the same bits that they revealed to us at age 1 and 2. You know, what matters to them, their personality, their character, their way of being was formed then. You know, it was maybe even formed in utero. I mean, they are who they are. And that's been pretty awe-inspiring to just see and witness.
How would you describe your parenting style?
Reformed. I'm definitely a reformed helicopter parent, or I'm in the process of reforming. You know, any psychologist would tell you that when you are deeply concerned about an issue, it's probably telling you something about yourself. To use a quite different example, often we see evidence that homophobic politicians, for example, who are the first to condemn the gay community, they themselves are closeted and it turns out are gay themselves. Often when we're critical about something, it's really because we're contending with that something in ourselves. And so that's certainly how it's been for me with helicopter parenting, as I've already confessed. So I think, you know, I'm reforming those tendencies. I'm kind I'm being kind with myself as I try to understand where those impulses come from and really work to stop them and undo the ways in which I am that. So that's sort of the label answer to the question, what kind of parent am I? But I think more philosophically, I root for all humans to make it in the world, and I'm not rooting for anybody more than I'm rooting for my own children. I'm loving, I'm funny, I think. That is, they laugh a lot at me. I do funny things. I just try to be authentic with them. I try to let them see the whole of me, maybe not all of me, but most of me. I try to just be regular and real with them. I'm not trying to perform the part of a parent. I'm just trying to be a parent, warts and all. Because I think that'll give them the greatest flexibility to be whatever kind of parent they want to be. And
You mentioned be a lot then, and that resonated with me a lot, because I feel like we get caught not only in our parenting lives, but in our day-to-day life, the day-to-day grind, as doing a lot, and we're continually doing. And talking to a lot of people through this COVID-19 pandemic situation, it has forced a lot of people to stop, reflect, and just be, which I think is profound and is going to have a positive effect moving forward as well for people that can, like you said at the start, or I think it might have been offline, it'll be great to see how people make these changes stick, these positive changes stick in their lives moving forward whenever this phase passes.
Yeah, absolutely.
What type of parenting did you experience as a child, Julie?
Now you're going to turn into my therapist, Sean. My parents were both highly educated. My father would be 102 had he lived. He died at 77. So he was really from a different era. He was born in 1918 and was a physician, which was very unusual for an African-American man. And his father was a physician. So my grandfather's one of the first black doctors in America. And that really was therefore meant that he was an atypical person, and my family was very atypical because of who he was. My mother has a PhD that she got while I was in high school and college. So they're both highly educated, and they both were hardworking and really passionate about what they did. He was in pediatrics and infectious disease, would be just so bewildered by our present moment of the inadequate response of America's leaders to some of them, to the coronavirus. My father helped eradicate smallpox. I'm glad he's not here to witness this. But high expectations, hard work, high achieving. So I grew up in a family where my mother wanted to ground me because I started to get some B's instead of having all A's. So there was a strict expectation around my behavior. I wasn't around my academic behavior and my other behaviors. I mean, I wasn't told what I should be, but I was told that I should be great at whatever I did. And I think there were ways in which that was a bit much, and that I felt conditionally loved rather than unconditionally loved, you know, loved when I was bringing home the right grades. Certainly felt that from my mom, whereas I felt my father loved me unconditionally. But in fairness to her, I think she was the one doing the child rearing while my father was busy with his career. So he and I just had a set of interactions that were not about homework or school or friends or discipline. It was just more of a loving, you know, a distant or an absent father who was very loving. And my mother was there dealing with the day to day. I think she was a little tiger type-ish in terms of you must, you will, thou shalt, but it wasn't so controlling that it was like I had to go to med school to please her. It wasn't that specific.
What lessons do you believe you took from your parents?
You know, there's one other thing I'm going to say, and in response to your next question too, in a different vein, address the kind of academic stuff, but she was also very, very uncomfortable with hitting me and, you know, with my sexuality, with my exploration of intimacy. Because she had some difficult experiences in her adolescence and young adulthood. She was terribly afraid of me entering that phase of life. And it really showed. So there was a lot of fear and there was a lot of control. And what I've learned from that is both my husband and I, and this in part just reflects when we grew up versus how the era in which we're parenting our kids, we both grew up in the 70s. You know, where young adults and teenagers took their relationships and their exploration of sex, like to the backseat of cars and, you know, empty lot and, you know, like hiding and whatnot. And our approach with our kids has been completely different. It's been when you're interested in somebody and you want to be behind closed doors with them in our house, you need to come to us. And this is in high school. You need to come to us and say, my relationship is consensual. It's mutually pleasurable and it's safe. And when you're mature enough to talk with us about that, then you will have the permission to be behind closed doors with this person. And once you've passed that threshold, the new rule, the next thing that we ask of you is that you, whatever you're doing is discreet and respectful, because intimacy is a beautiful thing and we respect that. We want to respect your relationships. But you also have to respect the other people in the house. So you don't like come upstairs from, you know, after school and have a snack and go upstairs and make noise with your significant other. That's not discreet or respectful. And that's just light years away from how both my husband and I were raised. And it's funny, I feel safe saying this. So, you know, they're 18 and 20. I think one day I will write about this when I feel like they're sufficiently through their early relationship stage such that I can talk about this without mortifying them. They might be a little mortified for me to be sharing this now, but it's safe, right? Because you're in faraway Australia.
You sound so calm, and I admire the way you sound calm about those conversations, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that have the same mindset. But take me back, and you don't have to go into detail, but when that first conversation come up for you, was it as calm as you're showing right now, or what did you feel in that moment?
Probably was it as calm? Yes and no. My husband and I were definitely clear that the way we had been raised, which was to hide things from our parents, lie about what we were doing, and, you know, just sort of feel guilty and whatnot, that wasn't a dynamic we wanted to have in our house or in our relationship with our kids. So we were coming from a place that was inherently one of wanting calm and peace and ease and of valuing intimacy and sex. I mean, we both were, you know, of that mentality, which allowed us to approach this topic more calmly than others might. But how to talk about it in a way that was clear, not ambiguous, not critical, and not totally permissive. And like, we didn't want to act as if we didn't care at all. And we didn't want to act as if we wanted to control. We wanted to be in this kind of middle space of ease and speak with authority and confidence, but in a way that was inviting of a conversation rather than shutting our kids down. So I think the short answer after the long answer is we did a lot. My husband and I did a lot of talking about it with ourselves before we talked about it with our kids, so that when we finally were ready to talk about it with them, we could be calm and level-headed because we'd already thought through the language we wanted to use. We kind of practiced it first, and I'm glad we did.
I admire that, those communication approach, being able to talk through that with your significant other before those conversations, not knowing how it will exactly go, but being on the same page. And that's something I think that can relate to other parts of a relationship. I know, for example, with Jess, both of us still being new parents, or I call us new parents still, having to fight and struggle to carve out time for us to be together, whether it's the way that we used to be, but just to be able to communicate and talk, because this day-to-day grind, it can be, and you put parenting on top of that, it can be quite difficult to find that time. So I admire that, the way that you guys in that situation, and I'm sure there's many others, are at the forefront of that, or have that front of mind.
Well, you haven't asked, but I'm going to give you some relationship advice, if not for you, for your listeners.
Please.
I do feel the obligation to pass this knowledge forward, because it was shared with me, and I'm sure it made a big difference. I've been with Dan for 32 years. Our kids are 20 and 18, so we've been at this a long time. But when we married, his grandmother, who was quite elderly at the time, pulled us aside and said, "Your kids will grow up and leave you. If you're fortunate, when they're gone, you'll still have each other. But it will not happen by accident. You have to work at maintaining this relationship. And that means you must go away regularly without your children." And I think she said regularly. She might have said, you know, a couple times a year. I don't know. But we made a commitment that once our children were, we would go away twice a year for an entire weekend. And we were fortunate. My mother was very part of our lives, so we had a trusted person we could leave our infant with, our toddlers with. But if you're, even if you don't have relatives nearby, you can work out this exchange with close friends. The key is that you go away for two nights, particularly when your kids are young. Those two nights are so important, not because the nights are wild, but because of the day in between. You want to go away, check into a place, go to sleep, you know, fool around, go to sleep, wake up whenever you feel like it. Whenever you feel like it, not because someone needs a feeding, someone needs a diaper change, someone's cranky, someone needs a nap. You spend that day how you want. You can spend it in bed. You can go out and see the town. You can read books. You can do whatever you want. You can do all of it. And you go to bed that second night. And then you check out the next morning. That day in between is the most magical day that parents of young children, you know, you've got a 2.5-year-old, right? How often are you getting a day just to be a couple? It's precious. And my husband, so Sawyer now 20, he's about to be 21. We have had 41 trips like this.
Wow.
Methodically every 6 months over these 20 and a half years. And there were times when, you know, we didn't have a lot to say and a connection wasn't there and no weekend away was gonna, you know, magically change things. But I can look back and say, had we not had that weekend away, things would have been even harder than they were in the hard years. And I just think it's been a secret for us of how to keep our love going. We call it love over time, like an equation, love, line, time, right? How we've stayed in love over time has been making sure that occasionally we center our relationship. We want our kids to know we're in love with each other. We want our kids to see what love looks like. We want them to know that adults make each other a priority, not that the kid is everything, like the kid matters, but also we matter. And we're trying to be good role models for them so that when the time comes and they're in serious relationships, that they know that relationships take work and deserve attention.
Consciously putting that time and energy into that. That's yeah. Really cool. How are you for time right now, Julie? I've got a few other questions I'd love to dive into, but I don't want to rush you.
I've got time. Let's continue.
Awesome. This has been really cool.
I'm enjoying it as well.
What's your opinion on kids using technology?
Technology enables connection with friends, enables discovery of information, is a way to engage a curious mind. It's part of our infrastructure. It's here to stay. Those are some of my responses in the positive column. Technology sucks us in. It makes us waste time. Harmful things can be out there that we can connect to via technology. There is the danger of addiction and scary things happening. And so, you know, my approach, as with many things, is that this is just about balance. It's not inherently bad, and it's not always good. And as parents, we have to be very educated about the mediums, you know, the apps, the games, the ways in which our kids are using technology. We have to have reasonable time and place restrictions depending on their age and stage, where we shouldn't shirk our responsibility and our authority as parents. You know, it's important to say you can't have your device always. It's important not to have devices out at meals. It's important to have limits. And often if we're the permissive, indulgent type of parenting, as I've told you, I have the propensity to be, it can be hard to enforce rules because we just want to please our kids constantly. It's really important to enforce some rules. And but then it's important to let our kids engage in these ways. When I see my kid Snapchatting another kid, I just smile, because it's, for me, it's like, you know, we used to pass notes to each other in school, and now they can Snapchat each other. That's really awesome. There are aspects of technology that delight me. My son is a Minecraft guy, and, you know, I didn't really understand what Minecraft was. I didn't really get it until he had a Minecraft party, you know, for a birthday party. All these guys brought their devices over. They just played Minecraft all night. And they were shouting about, like, pink pigs and you have my sheep and what happened to my, you know, I mean, I was like, what? What is this? I knew it wasn't like a violent game, but I don't think I realized it was like this building of a world game. And
it's cool how that connected your son and his friends in some way. Like, it's another form of connection. It's not the connection that that first comes to mind when you think of human connection, but it is another way of connecting.
Right. And yeah, to your point of human connection, research is really clear that we need to be making eye contact if we are able, that is not dealing with some kind of challenge that makes us, you know, like unable to make eye contact with humans. If we are able, we must.
Like a screen.
Regularly, because we need this connection, this eye contact, this smile. We need touch. We need close proximity to other humans to be well mentally. And so we can't be so wedded to our device.
It's interesting. One of the approaches that both Jess and I have adopted with Oscar and technology, because we've come to the point where it's inevitable that there's going to be consumption of technology, of screen time heading into the future. However, though, there's also opportunity for creation. And you mentioned balance before. I honestly see it as a blend of creation and consumption. So consumption is everything from, yeah, like you said, watching TV. It might be playing a game, which can be creation as well. But then I see creation as drawing on an iPad, painting on an iPad, maybe writing a story, depending on what age they are, on the show that they just watched or the movie they just watched, taking photos in nature. There is this ongoing challenge of finding that blend between consumption and creation, but it's something that is holding us in good stead, and we are both comfortable with it and believe that at the end of the day, there's those recommendations about screen time for children. In my personal opinion, I don't think they're realistic in the modern family dynamic. That's just my personal opinion. And that's where just, I suppose, the principle of, okay, creation and consumption. And that's something that's just constantly in our minds. Like if he has watched a movie, well, obviously then the ratio to come back into check for us is, okay, Oscar, if you want to do some more stuff with technology, let's draw a picture on the iPad or some sort like that. So yeah. it's a challenge.
Yeah.
But it's something that is inevitable, I think, as well. So being able to adapt and work with Oscar, work with our children instead of talking to them or talking at them, to be able to make it work as well.
Yeah. You know, let me say one thing, which is I love what you and Jess are doing. It sounds really wonderful. I love the concept of what was it? Creation and
consumption.
Consumption, that's right. I love that. Do you know the resource Common Sense Media?
No, I haven't heard of it.
It's a company that is out of the US, English based, but also Spanish available, where they're rating media and technology for suitability for children as young as toddlers all the way up to young adulthood. Yeah, so they have you know, experts on the staff who are watching and reading and interpreting media and giving it a rating of what age group it's appropriate for and what are the issues that may arise that might concern you as a parent. It's a really excellent resource. I'm biased. I'm on the board of Common Sense. It used to be Common Sense Media. Now they just call themselves Common Sense, but it's really fantastic. And the user interface is lovely. And so it's easy to use and it's fun to use. And they have a lot of different things. So I encourage you to check it out, because I think you might find it useful as you're raising little Oscar. And as a given that you're a resource for other parents, they might find it valuable too. I also want to go back and say one more thing about my partner and about parenting and keeping your relationship going. You know the concept of the five love languages, right?
I do. I'm all about the physical touch.
You are? Okay. My husband is that way, is a touch person, and I'm a words person.
So is Jess. Wow.
Yeah. Okay, right? And we've been together for 32 years, but we didn't know about the love languages maybe until 5 or 6 years ago. And it just was so illuminating, because when I'm stressed, angry, fearful, worried, insecure, I want Dan to look me in the eye and say, like, you're fine, you're great, you're amazing, like, whatever. I need that. And he wants to envelop me in his arms. Yeah, because he thinks that's what I need. And when he's stressed, you know, I want to just look him in the eye and tell him, gosh, you've got this, like, you're, and he wants a hug, you know, and we were just misfiring. And once we realized what the other one's language was, we could speak it. I don't know if my internet went out. Once we realized each other's languages, we could speak it. The other day in bed, he rolled over to me in the morning and he said, what can I do for you today to make your day easier? And it was the most beautiful request.
Wow.
And to have a partner, and of course I gave him my answer and I asked him the same question. You know, when if we're both working to do what the other one most needs, we're going to meet in this amazing sweet spot in the middle where we can both feel safe that our needs are noticed and are being met, or that the person is trying to in some way meet our needs. They're not responsible for meeting all of our needs, but if they take an interest in what our needs might be, if we both do that, there's this beautiful sweet spot that really is a place of joy for couples, I believe.
That's beautiful, giving to your significant other in that way. It's actually quite mind-boggling that you just mentioned that. So basically every week I've tried to make a habit of time blocking for reflection. I break down my life into three areas at the moment in terms of personal, so things to do with myself, whether it's health, whether it's spirituality, whether it's upskilling and learning and reading and studying. And then I break it into business and my professional life. And then the third, which I see as being most important right now, is relationships, with both Jess and Oscar being at the core of that. And each week I rate each area and say, what have I made progress on in each area? And what can I improve in the next week and moving forward? And one of the improvements that I listed for relationships was just asking Jess the question of, how can I be a better support or a better partner on a daily basis? And so for you to mention that now, it's I don't believe in coincidences. I believe in moments of significance, and that's a moment of significance for me. So that's really cool. I appreciate you sharing that.
I'm glad. The other thing I got to say, Sean, is you seem very aware, self-aware, interested in your own learning and growth, very grounded. And I don't mean to sound like an obnoxious older person by saying this, but you seem older than you are in that sense, or wiser. I'll just own it, wiser than I was when I was your age, or what I perceived to be your age. You know, I told this same story about my husband rolling over in bed and asking, you know, what can I do for you today to make your day easier or better? I told it on a webinar I gave yesterday to a group of parents in Miami, Florida. It was like a 40-minute webinar with Q&A after of 10 tips for sheltering in place without losing your mind. And I told this story about how we have to ask for what we need and we have to show up and help. You know, we have to be unafraid to ask and unafraid to give around our needs as a couple and a family. And so then when we got to the Q&A, which was moderated by one of the administrators, the most commonly asked question was something about, how can I find someone like Dan, my husband?
Wow.
I had managed to tell it in a way that all of the viewers were like really wishing they had someone like my husband in their life, which was the most beautiful thing. I mean, I went and told him afterwards, and, you know, I wanted to honor who he is and share with him how it had come across. But I think who he is and how he is isn't magical. It's partly how he was raised and partly who he innately is. But I think it's a learning that's accessible to all of us. It's not that hard to shift to being interested daily in what we can, and one thing we can do to make our partner's life easier or happier or more beautiful.
To give to someone else. And I think, from my personal opinion, I have an inkling of why that might be so astonishing for others, and it is for me, even listening to it in a ways, because it's so easy to get caught up in what's going on in our worlds individually and thinking about self day to day, instead of being able to take our minds outside of that and think about someone else and how we can more specifically give or serve someone else, which I think is really beautiful. And again, I admire just those little moments that there's such teachable moments, and for you to be able to share them with people on the webinar, with myself and the Sounding Board Parenting listeners right now, it's really cool. And you might not think it, but I can honestly see how it's making the impact that it is across the world. And like we were talking about offline, your message, whether it's through the TED Talk, through your books, or through this conversation right now, is something that is reaching far and wide, like Perth, Australia, which I'll be honest is known as a fishbowl in Australia, because we're completely on the opposite side of the country to your Sydneys and Melbournes. But I really appreciate you sharing that with me. And just before we wrap up, I've just got a final couple of questions. The first of those two being, if you could transport back in time with one piece of parenting advice to your pre-parent self, what would it be?
It would be, don't do for them what they can already do for themselves, or what they can almost do for themselves, because that's the only way they learn.
When did that become clear to you? Just curious.
When I was researching over parenting, you know, I was reading the work of Madeline Levine, who's a wonderful author and psychologist here in California, who I'm quoting in offering that advice to my younger self. As we look at what impedes a child's progress and undermines their mental health, that's a lovely summary of what not to do. Because basically, our children need to grow and learn every skill, every capacity, every competence. You know, they need to try and fail and try again, and it might take some time and it might be messy. And of course we can do it better. We're grown-ups. Of course we can do it more quickly. Of course we can do it more neatly. Like, think of loading the dishwasher. Some parents are so worried about everything lined up perfectly, they don't let their kid ever do it. Their kid never learns, you know? So it's, we have to tolerate what seems like imperfection or dawdling, or, you know, just not things being done as beautifully or correctly. We have to tolerate all of that, because the point is they're learning. And, you know, I didn't really fully appreciate that until I was, you know, scolding people for overparenting their university student, and started to read up on what was going on and what I wanted to try to offer by way of an author on this subject. And I got this insight, like, oh my gosh, I'm doing these things. I tied my kid's shoes too long. I cut his meat too long, you know? I held her hand crossing the street too long. I'm supposed to be teaching instead of doing everything for them.
It takes guts to accept our kids as who they really are, doesn't it?
You know, I don't know if it takes guts or it takes humility. I think many of us dreamed when we found out we were pregnant, or our partner was pregnant, or we're having a baby come into our lives, like, oh, I hope they'll be this, you know, I hope they'll be great at this. They want to be loved because they exist. They want to be loved. I'm seeing my internet is a little weird. They want to be loved as they are. And that's a universal desire. And the sooner we can get that as a parent, the more unconditionally we can love our children always.
Love, time, and support. That's really cool. What are you loving about parenting right now in this moment?
Two things. Number one, I've got the unanticipated gift of my 18-year-old daughter, my 20-year-old son, back home when one was up in Oregon and one was out in North Carolina. I'm enjoying these moments mostly for the gift that they are, just getting to be with them again in a way in which was not anticipated. Often we realize when it's too late, you know, oh, because a person has died, oh, I didn't spend enough time with them. This is sort of that opposite. It's like, it's unexpectedly they've returned. Let me make the most of it. And I think I am, and I think they are. And the other thing is, there's an article in the Atlantic magazine this week that talks about kids and anxiety and what we do as parents that might actually be contributing to their anxiety, and what we parents need to do differently to undo that. And I really saw myself in that article, and I encourage any reader, any listener who's interested in the subject to check out this article in the Atlantic about children and anxiety. And, you know, the examples they give are just too close to home for me. So I'm made uncomfortable, but I'm glad for that discomfort, because that tells me I'm feeling this for a reason, and I'm really interested in helping, you know, my kid with anxiety kind of move beyond that and gain more control back over, you know, their sense of what they can do with their life, or just with their days, with their self. So it's been how I'm feeling right now is I'm a learner again. I'm a learner as a parent. I'm deeply interested in continuing to be who this kid, both kids deserve as a parent. And if that means being humble and taking a beginner's mentality and learning and listening and being willing to admit my mistakes or my fears, you know, I'm confident that that's good, because that'll ultimately serve my kid. And, you know, that's what I'm here to do.
For what it's worth, I honestly think yourself and Dan are beautiful and awesome parents all in one. And you've been so generous with your time, Julie, which I'm really grateful for. And it's great to connect with you. And thank you for joining us on the Sounding Board Parenting Podcast.
Sean, thank you. Can I tell your listeners how to keep up with me? Is that okay?
Of course, yeah. So we normally finish off with the segment Time to Plug Off. So yeah, the floor is yours. Where can they find your work? Are you on social media? And what's next for you as well?
Absolutely. Thanks. The best way to follow me or to connect with me is probably go to my website, julieliftcotthames.com. That's my name, full name without the hyphen.com. There you can connect. You can get my newsletter, sign up for that. I'm on social, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, all the same handle, J. Lithcott Hames, but all of that is available through the website. So I think that's the best resource. I've got books you can buy at bookstores, online, How to Raise an Adult, Real American. The third book is underway. It's coming out April 6, 2021. It's called It's Your Turn, The Real How-To on Adulting.
We can edit that out, but just before you went off, you just mentioned your third book. So I don't know if you want to go into that again.
Yeah, thank you. The third book is a sequel to How to Raise an Adult for Young Adults. It's called It's Your Turn, The Real How-To on Adulting. And it's a compassionate beckoning of young adults into this place we call adulthood, which recognizes, yes, it's terrifying, but it's also delicious. So come on, let's go. It's your turn. And it'll be out next April 2021. And I hope folks will check it out when the time comes, if it sounds intriguing. It's for young adults, kind of age 18 to 30. Anyone who's kind of not sure about becoming an adult or whether they're doing it right and all that.
Sounds like you're opening a can of worms there. I'm excited to jump into that.
Yeah.
That'll be awesome. Sure. I hope you have found your time on the Sounding Board Parenting Podcast to be enjoyable, Julie. Again, thank you so much for offering up your time. And I wish yourself, Dan, Avery, and Sawyer all the best into the future.
And to you, Jess, and Oscar as well, Sean. This has been a treat. You asked great questions. Really, really not the typical podcast. So I hope all your listeners know they've got something very special in the Soundboard Parenting Podcast.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. Personally, these interviews are providing me a time to reflect on my week as a parent. Let me know if anything stood out for you during the chat. As the new pod on the block, yes, dad jokes are welcome here, it would be great if you could look out for us and share this episode with someone that you think may be interested. While you're at it, why not head to our socials and show some love with a like, follow, or comment. Keep an eye out for the next pod drop. Big thanks to Steelo Media for producing this piece of art we call Sounding Board Parenting. From my heart to yours, I hope you are making progress on something you love and something that makes you feel alive. Remember, this can go anywhere.